From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about the Rorschach inkblot test. And quick, what comes to mind when you think of the inkblots? You think it's a gimmick, right? Or at least a very subjective experiment? Well, the writer Damien Searles says those inkblots are a very sensitive and very accurate tool for showing how the mind works. He has a book that tells about Rorschach and his inkblots, and he'll join us to talk about it after this.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You might be surprised to learn that some psychologists are still using the Rorschach inkblot test as a tool for diagnosing certain mental conditions. Now, it's not the only test they would try. There are limits, and there is by no means consensus on the use of the Rorschach test or its validity. But supporters say that in some cases, the Rorschach test can reveal issues other tests might miss. Damien Searles has written a book about these inkblots. He explores how they work, how they've become a part of art and cultural history, how they were created by Hermann Rorschach, a Swiss psychiatrist and amateur artist. Searles says Rorschach managed to invent an enormously influential psychological test, but also a visual and cultural touchstone. Searles' book is The Inkblots, Hermann Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and the Power of Seeing. Searles has written for Harper's, The Paris Review, among others. He joined us from a studio in New York City. You say in the book that you came to the inkblots from the cultural side. And I'm guessing in those early days as you were thinking about this, I'm wondering if you felt ambivalent or how you felt at all about the idea of the Rorschach test. Just to start from that idea that you sort of came from the cultural side and were kind of ambivalent about whether it worked as a, you know, quote-unquote test.
Well, sure. You know, I had the same kind of idea about it as everyone else. I'd read, I don't know how many hundred newspaper articles where some political candidate or football game or movie star is called a Rorschach test. And I kind of knew what that meant. And I sort of had a picture from old movies of some white-coated doctor showing someone an inkblot and suddenly they're magically saying, oh, I hid the murder weapon in the third drawer, you know. So I had just that kind of vague idea like everyone else. What I guess I mean when I say I came from the cultural side is that I first started to find out a little bit about where and when it was invented and the sort of context it came out of, and also that it's, you know, a real test that actually works and works in a way that's a lot more interesting than the cliche I had in my mind. So it just kind of turned into this question, not only, wow, what is this thing? Does it really work? But also what made it turn into a household name that we all have heard about Rorschach tests, even though none of us really know what it is.
We'll get into this deeper as we go. But you say Rorschach, Hermann Rorschach, was unique among the pioneers in psychology. In this sense, he was a visual person. He created a visual psychology. Say something about that early on, because I think that's really critical to understand the distinctions here and why this is important.
Yes. So he was a doctor. I mean, he worked in a hospital with schizophrenic people and stuff like that. But his dad was a drawing teacher. He was a lifelong amateur artist. And he always had this sense that, you know, how people see the world is how people's minds work. If you think about Freud was really a talker. He was a word guy. He would put you on a couch and talk to you and listen to you. And, you know, Freud is all about Freudian slips, what you say and don't say, things like that. Rorschach was much more about how you see things, how you go about the task of looking at the world and processing it. And as a visual artist, he was able to first of all, appreciate how important that is, and secondly, kind of craft this way to examine how you go about seeing things.
Mm. You, Freud was a word person. You yourself are a word person, but you're married to a visual person. So I'm wondering.
Yeah, funny how that works, right?
Funny how that works, right? I mean, how did your wife's perspective help influence the way you thought about the visual part of the story?
You know, I had a lot more about that in the book at one point, but I took it out because I wasn't sure in the end how much of it was just personal,
yeah,
and how much was really relevant in terms of, you know, who has an easier time finding things around the apartment or something. Like, is that really because I'm a visual person or a guy or just because I'm me, you know? So I didn't end up doing anything quite as literal as that in terms of explaining, like, oh, I wrote this in the book because my wife's a visual person. But the deeper thing is that I do appreciate, and I also came to appreciate much more in the course of writing the book, how deep visual perception goes in our minds. Yeah. You know, some estimates go as high as 85% of our brains are devoted to visual processing. When we see things, they hit us. You can manage what you want to say, but you can't really manage what you want to see. I mean, it's there for you. It's immediate. And you react to it on this incredibly deep and primal, visceral, bodily level. Mm-hmm. So it really makes sense that how you respond to visual things will say a lot about how your mind works.
But you say after Rorschach that the idea of this visual component of psychology wasn't the great path that's really been taken. We went with the words part more than the visual part.
Well, yeah, and I think that's true across all sorts of parts of life. I mean, think about school, right? There's numbers, and that's the real stuff. Yeah. And then there's sort of stories, and some people appreciate that stories and how we talk about things and how we, you know, make narratives out of things is important too. But, you know, when's the last time a historian had to make a charcoal drawing of what he was talking about in order to really understand, you know, how the battle shaped up, or to understand what was going on inside someone's head by drawing a portrait of him or something like that? You know, there are visual ways of understanding the world, and there's visual intelligence, and we all know this in our lives. But in scholarship and in science, math and, to in second place, words tend to be what people take seriously.
So
that's how it seems to me. I mean, you're a radio guy, right? Is the stuff you do taken as real, or is it just, you know, subjective storytelling as opposed to the hard statistics?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think any of us who try to tell stories, stories are not taken as seriously as the intrinsic facts associated with the stories themselves, even though, and if you think about really great reporting, the insights come in the context of the story. And that's often the last thing that they think about. I don't know why that is, but that bias seems to be there. I think that's something that I've noticed for sure.
And if stories aren't taken seriously enough compared to math, just think about pictures.
Yeah.
That stuff is seen as really subjective. And I think a lot of the kind of general public's sense of the Rorschach test, certainly mine going into this project, comes out of this real suspicion that, you know, how I see something that must automatically be totally subjective. But in fact, you know, if you think of it in terms of, well, if you're confronted with an image and you don't piece the different pieces together in a way that's within the normal range of the million other people who've looked at this image, well, then you may be super creative, or you may have certain visual or cognitive problems. I mean, that's actually a pretty reasonable conclusion, it seems to me. But that's not how we think of it. We always think of looking at pictures as this totally meaningless, subjective thing.
Yeah. One of the first steps that you took in this process of digging into Rorschach was to take the real Rorschach test yourself. And you go through some of this in the book. Do you mind taking us through the experience a bit?
Yeah, sure. So the thing about the Rorschach test, there are a couple of basic facts that were sort of the first things I learned that I didn't know. One is that there are 10 images, and there are only 10 that Hermann Rorschach made and put in the sequence that he wanted. So every single Rorschach test that's ever given in the world shows the same 10 images that are on kind of cardboard cards in the same order. It's not that you make your own or that the doctor makes his own,
right,
or that they're random. I mean, they're actually crafted by Hermann Rorschach himself. The other thing I didn't know, for example, is that some of them are in color. They really are these fascinating pictures because they don't look like nothing. They don't look like just a smear or a carpet or a cloud or something like that. If everyone said something different, it wouldn't really be much of a test.
Right.
It would just be like free associating.
But that's what everyone thinks they are.
Exactly. So the experience when you look at it is like, wow, this really does kind of look like two waiters bowing to each other or, you know, a bear climbing up a tree or something.
Yeah.
Not exactly, but not nothing. So it's not that you feel yourself kind of imagining something that you could say it is. It's not a test of imagination.
Yeah.
What it is a test of perception. What do you see and how do you see it? Do you start at the whole image and then home in on details, or do you start with details? Do the colored images, does the color make you sort of see better or does it distract you? Do you see the scenes as living and moving? In other words, are the two gorillas high-fiving or are they two statues of gorillas next to each other?
Yeah.
It's actually that kind of thing that the doctor will write down and then code. In other words, if you see things as moving, you'll get an M code. If you use color in your response or react to the color, you'll get a C code for color and things like that. So it's really not about, you know, if I see a bunny in a field, then I'm a happy person. And if I see an axe murderer, then I'm crazy,
yeah,
which is sort of the idea I had and the idea that most people have. It's really much more formal and structural about, like, how does your perception work? So what literally happens is you sit there, and the examiner, who's usually a doctor, will hand you the first card and say, what do you see? What might this be?
Yeah.
Not how do you feel or tell me a story or what do you imagine,
yeah,
but just perceptually, what do you perceive? What is this? And then you give ideally two or three answers in the current way of giving the test. If you start to give too many answers, they'll say thank you and take the card back. And if you just give one, then they'll sort of say, oh, is there anything else? And so you just say what you see. It doesn't have to be the whole card. You can turn it around. It's really up to you how you go about this task.
Yeah.
And then so they go through the 10 cards and they write down everything you say. And then after they've written it down, they go back through to sort of say, okay, where did you see the brain flying through the air? Where did you see the snake, the bears, whatever it is? And so in that round, you're not giving more answers. They're just sort of able to take better notes on where you saw the different things or whatever.
Yeah.
Then they go off and they give each of your answers various codes, like I mentioned. And then they plug the codes into these formulas. You know, what percent of your answers are animals? What percent of your answers are color-based? Things like that. And that produces the test results that then get interpreted by a trained psychiatrist or psychologist. It's actually very technical. Like, I couldn't give someone a Rorschach test now, having written this book.
I could show someone
the cards, but
yeah,
I wouldn't know what to do with it because it's actually very technical.
Well, this is a point you keep coming back to kind of time and time again in the book, and it's important to say this is not just a parlor game. I mean, there is scientific rigor associated with this test. I mean, it has to be taken under the right conditions.
Well, sure, like any other, you know, test situation. But that's the fascinating thing about it. It really is on this borderline. You know, it's not like a blood test. It's not that cut and dried.
Right.
But it's also not like free associating with a shrink where, you know, it's just this unique one-on-one interpersonal situation and you're just talking about whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, for one thing, millions of people have looked at these same 10 cards and their answers have been tabulated. So you can just go look up in the table in the manual, you know, is this a common answer or is this a weird, unusual answer? You can just look up, oh, if you see movement response even in this card, like, mm-hmm. is that usual or unusual? And all sorts of correlations with people's diagnoses are recorded. So, you know, there is real objectivity involved. Once you've coded it and scored it properly, there's real facts about what that means.
Right, right.
One of the decisions you had to make when you were starting to, you know, get to the publishing point of the book was whether or not you should reproduce the real ink blots. And as I said, and we'll talk about here, there are only 10 of these. They're not metaphors. They're, you know, designed to elicit subjective, not designed to elicit subjective impressions. You know, they have their real purpose. So you had to decide whether you could write a book, I guess, that explores these ink blots in, you know, in real detail and decide whether you could actually reproduce them. I mean, that's a tough call because, as you say, it's a pretty sensitive thing. A lot of really respected clinical psychologists and people think it's a bad idea. So just
right.
talk about how you were thinking about this and where you came down.
Well, so in years past and decades past, one of the first things you learned when you were in psychology school studying this is don't show the images around.
Yeah.
And books would publish sort of outlines of them or blur them out or in some way not reproduce the real ones. It's still the case that, you know, my editor told me that a friend of hers who is a psychologist said, oh, are you working on anything interesting? And she told him about this book. And the first words out of this friend's mouth are, you're not going to publish them, are you?
Right.
And to which my editor said, well, you know, all 10 are up on Wikipedia in color.
Yep.
And the friend didn't really have a response to that. You know, she had learned in grad school, don't publish them. And so that's what her fallback position was. And I mean, in reality, that cow has left the barn.
Yeah.
You know, they're all up on the internet, not to mention on, you know, plates and T-shirts and all over the place. Most of the ones that you see on, like, TV show credit sequences or advertisements or something aren't the real ones.
Right.
They're just some other ones that are made to look Rorschach-y.
Yeah.
But the real ones, you know, are out there if you want to look. So, but I ended up, and I mean, not just me, I and the current science says just being exposed to them doesn't ruin the test because it's not like a word association test. It's
yeah.
not about what's your first reaction. It's about how are you perceiving things. And how you perceive things a second time is also psychologically interesting. You know, so it just seemed to me that that there wasn't enough downside to outweigh the fact that these images really are very unique and fascinating. And if you're talking about them in an art history context, in a cultural context, you kind of have to see them.
There's a story you tell at the beginning of the book that I think really illustrates this point you make that these ink blots are not just, you know, some subjective diversion. And this story didn't happen so long ago. It's about a man named, you call him Victor Norris. It's not his real name. And he's applying.
Not his real name.
Not his real name. He's applying for a job to work with young kids. And so he goes through this usual battery of tests and evaluations, you know, to see if he's fit for such a job. And as you tell it in the book, he did really well on a lot of these tests. They liked him. They thought he seemed smart and likable. But then we get to the ink blot test, that part of it. And then this is where the story kind of twists. We take it from here and explain this story, because I think, it's a good illustration of your point.
Yeah. I mean, it was an amazing story for me to find out, too. Sure, he's charming in interviews. He's perfectly fine on other psychological tests. And then suddenly, when faced with these ink blots, he starts describing these, you know, horrific, violent scenes and all of this stuff that you can just kind of imagine the bad guy who you don't want working with kids saying. And so the therapist examining him sort of says, thank you very much, we'll be in touch, and then goes through, as I mentioned, the process of actually scoring and coding and doing the test, because it's not just about what you say, it's about how the numbers play out.
Yeah.
And sure enough, concludes that this person has a fragile hold on reality and should not get the job, and then doesn't. So, you know, 10 or 12 years later, this examiner gets a phone call from a private therapist who's working with a client named Victor Norris. And she's like, oh, yeah, I remember him. Mm-hmm. And is not allowed to go through all the details, but basically says what she had found. And this therapist at the other end of the phone said, you got all that from a Rorschach test?
Yeah.
I've been seeing him for 3 years in therapy. I, you know, we're just getting to that now. I thought the Rorschach test was tea leaves.
Right.
That's why I opened the book with that story, because if nothing else, it shows that there's more going on here than you think.
The ink blots, you point this out too, they're not a test that has the power to say definitely, hey, that person is a serial killer or a child molester.
Right.
I mean, the ink blots reveal important things about people, but it's not such a blunt instrument. I mean, you do point that out, and Rorschach himself was pretty adamant about this.
Yeah, he put it in terms of that it shows the quality and not the quantity of psychological characteristics. So in other words, it shows if you have schizophrenic tendencies, not whether or not you are schizophrenic or how severely. In fact, he was even realizing that it shows latent schizophrenia. So if you have no symptoms and never have, but the test could show that you sort of had those, you leaned that way. Mm-hmm. And that raised some kind of dicey issues of like, how do you tell someone that? So it can't say if you've ever acted on your various impulses. It can't say if you control your inclination to be super introvert or super extrovert or whatever it is. But it can sort of show that that's how your mind operates qualitatively instead of quantitatively.
Yeah.
And so I should say, you know, it is used today all the time, but it's never used by itself. I mean, no responsible person would ever make a real world decision solely on the basis of a Rorschach test.
Yeah.
It's used in combination with interviews and other more numerical tests and questionnaires and things like that. But the thing about it is, you know, a questionnaire like the MMPI, which is the most used psychological test today, other than like an IQ test. So the MMPI has all these true or false questions. You agree or disagree with a bunch of statements. And the thing about it is that that's your take on yourself. That's how you are choosing to answer the question. And even if you're being totally honest, it's about how you see yourself, which is important. But how you perform in a context where you don't know how to stage manage how you're coming across is also important. And so the way a lot of people think about the Rorschach now is that it's a performance test and not a self-report test. It's how you actually go about this task where there isn't a clear right answer. I mean, if you see something that looks like a bat, should you say it's a bat because it looks like a bat, or should you not say it's a bat? I mean, you don't really know. It's kind of mysterious. So that is one of the real values of the Rorschach test, that it's not your answer to a question about yourself. It's just you showing how you go about doing something.
Damien Searles. His book is called The Ink Blots, Herman Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER's new project, The Hive Mind, puts you right in the newsroom with our reporters. Here's how it works. Look under the News and Programs tab at KUER.org, click on The Hive Mind, and you'll see what one of our reporters is working on. Maybe it's affordable housing or national parks fees. It changes. You tell us what you want to know, vote on other listeners' questions, and we'll try to figure it out. It's like this. The news is for you, and you should have some say in how we make it. Join The Hive Mind at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Rorschach inkblot test, which most people think is a very subjective experiment, like looking at abstract art. Everyone is entitled to their own interpretation. Well, the writer Damien Searles says that is not, in fact, how the Rorschach test works. He's written a book called The Ink Blots, Herman Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and The Power of Seeing. He's joining us today to talk about it. Let's talk about Herman Rorschach, because a good part of this, of course, is his story. Born in 1884, a light-bringing year, as you explain, and a lot going on in Zurich when he's born, which seems like a modern, dynamic, exciting place. And it seems like at least the early days before his parents tragically die, it seemed like a really creative environment, his home life early on.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the other untold story I sort of came across in starting to look into the Rorschach test. There's never been before this book a biography of Herman Rorschach, even in German. Historians of psychiatry have been interested in him. There was one article in the 50s about his life, but no one had ever sort of dug in and uncovered what's there. And kind of the amazing thing is that he's a really good guy. You know, most people, even when they finish reading a biography, much less writing one and, you know, uncovering all the dirty secrets and everything, don't really like the person anymore. But he was really solid. He was like modest and hardworking and really great to the women in his family and in his life.
And handsome, we have to point out. Like the photo on the cover, it's like one of those Hollywood images that, like, that does not seem old. That seems like a modern photo. And he was a handsome guy.
He was. You know, I don't know if it's still true, but certainly when I was writing the book, if you typed Herman Rorschach into Google, the first thing that came up would be Separated at Birth pages with him and Brad Pitt with
right.
that same photo from
right.
the cover.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason the publisher picked it.
Yeah.
I agree also that it seems very contemporary. I mean, if you know about people like Freud and Jung, they have these like wacky ideas mm-hmm. and they go to seances and they have very old-fashioned ideas about men and women. And Rorschach really was a modern person, and including about the Rorschach test. You know, there's some very powerful letters that I find very moving after he's invented the test, and his colleagues are sort of chomping at the bit to start monetizing this and like, mm-hmm. let's start using it in the German school system, testing all the kids and vocational testing and so on. And Rorschach writes this letter like, whoa, hold your horses. Yes, it might work, but first we have to do all the statistics and all the control groups and be really responsible about this. You know, when I think of some kid who's wanted to go to medical school or university his whole life and being prevented from doing it because of this test, I feel like I can't breathe, he says in one of these letters. You know, so he's really a very responsible scientist once he invents the test. It's his artistic background that sort of made him appreciate the power of visual psychology. But then once he invents the test, it's all about getting a big sample size and control groups and handling it very responsibly. probably the most important thing in the history of the Rorschach test is that Hermann Rorschach died so young, less than a year after he invented it. And so the whole history of it becoming world famous was without him there to sort of keep a parental eye on it and keep it under control. So it really kind of exploded in all these different directions after he died.
His nickname was Inkblot in German, which is so
yeah, that's pretty funny. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
It's true and it's not true. So his nickname in fraternities, which were sort of late in high school, not just in college, in the German system, everyone got a nickname, and his was Klecks, which is the word for inkblot, but is also the word for like quick draw or something like that. Hmm. So he was obviously very good at drawing little cartoons or sketches of teachers or things like that.
Let's talk about some of those early experiments you write about early in his life as a student. He liked to read the mood. Well, for example, he experimented with pupils, how they grow and shrink. He experimented with this. He likes trying to test limits, and he there's another experiment you write about where he tried to transpose the discomfort from a toothache into music.
Well, I mean, in a way, we all do that, but he thought about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So his dissertation was on it has this very off-putting name, reflex hallucinations. But what that means is when seeing something makes you hear something, or hearing something makes you feel something, or something like that. Mm. And that is something that's true of normal people. But also, he was writing about, for example, his patients who, every time they saw someone mowing the lawn outside, would feel the blade cutting into their neck, their own neck, or something like that. And so for him, all of these very everyday experiences of transposing things or trying to, you know, remember a piece of music and you don't remember what it sounds like, but you remember your fingers on the piano. And then that sort of tactile memory kind of turns into a audio memory and you remember the tune. Things like that. So the relevance for that is that, of course, the Rorschach test is about kind of a crossover or equation between something you're doing visually and something you're doing psychologically.
Right. When he starts to see the potential for ink blots in his work, he came to realize that he needed just better ones, better images. And this is when he starts to craft his own. I mean, he is a terrific artist.
Well, I mean, let's not give him too much credit. I mean, he's not showing things in museums. He's not Picasso.
Yeah, of course.
But what he was he was very skilled, especially at showing kind of gesture. So he's very good at making cartoons. He kept a visual diary of his young children, not just a word diary, but he'd do these little sketches of, you
Those
know,
are great.
Putting her to sleep or her playing with her toy mobile over her crib or stuff like that. You know, he wasn't a genius fine artist, but he was very skilled with his hands. He also was good at woodworking and other kinds of things like that. So so he was able to kind of translate onto paper what he was trying to do. You know, there have been a lot of psychologists in the past century who've, for one reason or another, wanted to make another version of inkblots for their own version of the Rorschach test. And the thing is, none of them are good, you know?
Yeah.
Like, no matter how good your idea is and, oh, we want more blots that measure this or that, that doesn't mean you can actually make one that that looks dynamic but doesn't look dynamic to everybody or whatever it is. So inkblots, to get back to your question, had been used before kind of like tests of imagination. Mm-hmm. So more in the sense that we were talking about at the beginning where it's just a random smear and you give it to someone and you say, okay, what can you see here? not what do you see here, but like what can you see here if you try?
Yeah.
And if you come up with 25 things, then you are really imaginative. And if you come up with 2 things, then you're not very imaginative. It's like a memory test, but for imagination. And there are a bunch of problems with that approach. One is that it doesn't really do very much. And the other is it's not really very plausible because not every answer is an imaginative answer.
Yeah.
If you're a really perceptive person and you see a lot of things, that doesn't mean you have a good imagination. It means you see a lot of things
right.
and you're perceptive or you're detail-oriented or whatever. And then if you see things that other people don't see, well, it might mean you're imaginative. It might mean you're crazy. You know,
yeah.
it just doesn't get you very far
right.
to, like, count how many things you can say about a smear.
Yeah.
So in the early years, Rorschach did try something like that, where the images didn't really matter and he'd make new ones each time and just sort of show it to patients or school children and see what they could come up with. But he gave that up really pretty quickly because, you know, he knew that that wasn't really going to get anywhere.
Yeah. What's the importance of symmetry? Because you say, I mean, I can't imagine an ink blot test not having symmetry in it. But that wasn't necessarily inevitable, at least at first. I mean, it ended
right.
up
I mean, so if you think about the kind of test I'm saying, it doesn't have to be symmetrical. You just show someone a blob.
Yeah.
And say, okay, how many things might this be? The symmetry, you know, he said a few things about it. He said it makes it easier to see a whole scene. He said it makes it unbiased between left-handed and right-handed people, which is kind of an interesting thing to say. Mm. He said that it means that there are unfortunately many bats and butterflies, but the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. And intuitively or not, he really did know that the advantages outweigh the disadvantages. Not only are they all symmetrical, all 10 Rorschach blots, but they're also horizontally symmetrical. So
yeah.
that means the mirror line is a vertical line and the sides are the same. It's not like somebody looking down into a lake where it's vertically symmetrical. And that turns out to be super important because in terms of how our minds work, you know, other people's faces are symmetrical across a vertical axis. Mm. Our bodies are. Just the world is. People are next to each other in social situations, not like floating above each other.
Mm.
So having a scene that's horizontally symmetrical, that's what matters to us psychologically. That's what our visual systems are primed to notice. And that's what makes it possible to really identify with a lot of the images or to sort of see them as these social interactions or things like that. Horizontal symmetry is what's psychological. You know, that's what people are. That's what human situations are about. And so it really turns out to be very important in the Rorschach test that there's this horizontal symmetry.
One of the things you write about in the book are the critiques to the Rorschach test. How,
right.
You know, how they – some people see this as silly and kind of embarrassing that people are still using ink blots, that it's pseudoscience. And there are these two contrasting stories I wanted to ask you about that show the problems with the Rorschach test and then the advantages. And one of the problems is this tragic story you tell from 1985 of Rose Martelli,
right?
Woman who got into this child custody dispute with a man. And he was awarded custody after these psychological evaluations. And one of them being used, of course, was the Rorschach test, which had been used to label Rose Martelli as untrustworthy and emotionally disturbed. But it turns out it's the man who's disturbed. He had been sexually abusing and raping this 5-year-old boy, her son. And it raises these questions about how far the test can be taken and how it can be abused. Talk a
right.
little bit about that, because I want to talk about another story, which I think shows another view of this.
Well, a couple things to say about that. First of all, I don't want to give people listening the impression that I'm this advocate.
Yeah.
Or champion of the Rorschach test should be used more often or less often or whatever. That's another part of the fact that I came to it from the cultural side. You know, I'm not a crusader about personality testing. I'm not a scientist. It's not up to me to decide how valid it is and whether it should be used. So I just want to put that out there as a caveat to what I'm saying. Obviously, I think that it's misunderstood and it actually is more interesting than we think it is. But that doesn't mean that that this book is a polemic.
Right.
So,
one thing we should just say, this is a good point for me to just mention also, a lot of what this book is about is the cultural dynamics of Rorschach. It's about the art and the aesthetic related to it, Andy Warhol's impression of a Rorschach test and the way it's been used in music videos. And I mean, that's another really important part of it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I think it's such an interesting topic. Like, I wouldn't be interested in reading a book about the IQ test as much as I would be interested in reading a book about the Rorschach test, just because it kind of entered the culture and art in all these different ways. So for the Rose Martelli case, ultimately what happened in that story is that the person who gave the Rorschach test gave it badly, scored it wrong. Mm-hmm. It wasn't kind of compared and used properly in relation to other things like interviews. The Rose's lawyer like didn't have it double checked by someone else until it was too late. And so, you know, ultimately it doesn't really say anything about the validity of the test.
Yeah.
I mean, jury trial results in a lot of terrible injustices. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have juries or, you know, any other surgical procedure. Things can go wrong. But so ultimately, I don't think that the Rose Martelli case proves anything except, you know, how tragic and horrible things can be when they go wrong. Do you know what I'm saying?
Totally. Yeah.
Again, I feel like that sounds like special pleading when the guy who wrote a book on the Rorschach test says that. So that's why I wanted to sort of frame where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
It really boomed after World War II and became the most popular test in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And was being used in this very ham-fisted Freudian way, where if you see a man instead of a woman, you must be gay. If you see a pall of black smoke, you must be suicidal and let's get you into electroshock therapy, like this very ham-fisted way of using it. In the 60s, there started to be a real reaction against that, the same time that sort of Freud tumbled out of favor from being what psychiatry was to being this sort of fringe practice that, you know, would happen in the Upper West Side of New York, but that's about it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so a guy named John Exner came along and really sort of reinvented the Rorschach test by emphasizing these statistical mathematical aspects of it. So he really nailed down the administration procedures and the codes and started doing all of this very kind of technocratic, modern, scientific analysis of Rorschach results, with the result that it really did get accepted in the modern medical system and insurance companies would pay for it. And it really was sort of a validated test. Then in around the late 90s and early 2000s, was this second wave, including the guy who published the Rose Martelli story, of saying that
it's nonsense.
The Exner system was not valid and that a lot of these articles were flawed and things like that. So, I mean, I know this part of the story isn't very interesting, like up and then down and then up and then down. But now we're on an upswing in that in 2013, the leading psychology journal published a gigantic what's called a meta-analysis, which is where you sort of process every study on every part of the thing and do all the statistics and really validate it. It is the gold standard for validating something scientifically. And this journal had not published anything on the Rorschach for 40 years or something. But this 2013 study really nailed it.
Yeah.
And they found that some of the codes and scores were not valid and they threw those out. and they found that these other ones were very highly valid and those were kept in. And so the Rorschach test today really is scientifically validated. If you think that the Rorschach test is not science, then you're not up to date on the science. I mean, that's just where the state of the field is at.
I think that what's interesting too, though, is that you contrast that Rose Martelli story with this other, I have to say, is kind of a lovely story of this 12-year-old Basia Kaminska, who's this daughter of this immigrant single mother who was molested for years by this man. And it was the Rorschach test that revealed that despite her outward kind of cool exterior, that she had this deep emotional damage. I mean, in the end, you say, look, it didn't offer definitive proof, but you say that it helped the people in this case, in the courtroom in this particular case, see her in a different, important way.
Right. So in this case, there are details in the book, but basically the evaluator on all the other tests that this girl was being given would minimize everything and in interviews would say, oh, you know, it's no big deal. I don't really think about it. I don't really mind. It doesn't matter. And so all of those self-report tests where she would say how she's feeling, you know, didn't really get at what was going on. The two tests that showed unusual results were an IQ test, which showed that she was very intelligent, and a Rorschach test, which showed that she really was kind of damaged and fragile and barely keeping it all together, whereas underneath there was some real suffering going on. And what you're mentioning is that the psychologist who evaluated her. So eventually there was a lawsuit for damages, and the estate of the perpetrator, their lawyers said, oh, well, you said in an interview that nothing happened and it was no big deal. And so the lawyers for her side called the psychologist who read the actual response to the actual first card. And the response, it's a card that it's sort of normal to say it's a bat. People say that. But she said it was a bat with torn wings. There have been holes torn in these wings, and it's really sad.
Yeah.
And so this was something that the jurors could kind of connect to. Now, that's not scientific proof, and it's, as I keep saying, it's not about, you know, what you say. It's about how the codes and scores come out. But at the same time, you know, in a lawsuit in front of a jury, you have to tell the person's story in a way that's vivid and relatable and understandable. And to get up there and talk about meta-analyses and R-squared and all this other stuff isn't going to do the job as well as giving people a way to see what someone else is feeling. And ultimately, I think that's kind of a metaphor for the Rorschach test. You know, getting back to the popular cliche of it, when some public figure or event is called a Rorschach test in the newspapers, what they mean is, you know, you decide, there's no wrong answer, whatever you think is fine, and now we'll go on to the next story. We're not going to tell you if the budget adds up or not. We'll just say it's a Rorschach test, and this side likes it and this side doesn't like it. So it's this kind of metaphor cliche for just total relativism, like anything goes, no wrong answer. I actually think that the real Rorschach test is kind of the opposite, because what the real Rorschach test is about is you look at this thing and you tell me what you see, and then I can look at the same image myself and try and put myself in your shoes. And there's this kind of common ground between us because there is this actual ink blot here that we can both look at and we can both sort of try and come together in terms of seeing the same thing. And you know, that's how it was used in this courtroom case. It kind of gave the jurors a way into how she was seeing the world and how she felt that that was very convincing.
You say when it comes to the inkblot test, humility is the key.
Well, that's true for everything, right? I mean, there's no magic mind reading psychological test that's 100% accurate and easy to give and, you know, will tell you everything you want to know about a person. And only if you get tempted into thinking that are you going to start using it in these horrible ways, like in the Rose Martelli case where you let it override the other information and make a terrible decision or something like that. The Herman Rorschach's own approach and just, you know, the general approach of some humility about the tools you're using, whether it's a jury trial or a scientific test or anything else, you know, it's always a good idea.
That's the writer Damien Searles. His book is called The Inkblots, Herman Rorschach, His Iconic Test, and the Power of Seeing. He joined us from a studio in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.